Hello and welcome to Midori House and Monocle 24's first outside broadcast, live from Washington DC with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's programme, we speak to Hisham Mellon, the Washington Bureau Chief of Al Arabiya, about developments in the Arab world and US foreign policy.
We'll also hear from Derek Brown, the best bartender in town, about food and drink culture in DC.
All that, plus a mix of the best music, right here on Midori House, live from Washington, here on Monocle 24.
And here we are in Washington, D.C. at the studios of WAMU 88.5, no less.
And they're nice, but they're not quite as nice as Midori House, I don't think.
Are they not?
It's a bit bright in here.
We're so used to doing
almost in the kind of pitch black of Midori House in our nice little kind of cocooned studios.
It's not quite as cosy, no, but it is nice to be out on the road and doing it sort of somewhere else.
And we're here for a reason.
Yes, we are. We are. We're launching our Denmark survey later on tonight.
And because you had a lot to do with Denmark, you've somehow managed to end up here as well, haven't you?
Yeah, because I was so intimately involved with the Denmark survey, I thought it was only fair that I should be the one that comes over here with you and Tyler to host the party.
And can we just say how hot it is as well?
It is unseasonably hot. We all packed our winter clothes and a big sort of, you know, woolly coats and scarves and hats and so on. And we got to New York over the weekend and it was sort of a balmy 17 or 18 degrees.
I think especially Jonathan Openshaw, because in honour of Denmark, I think he shipped in most kind of Denmark's knitwear with him and he hasn't unpacked one piece of it yet.
Yeah, he has a lot of woolly jumpers, which we haven't seen any of yet. Hopefully, you know, you never know, he might get a chance to break them out. We've got a lot coming up in the next hour here in Washington. But before all that, we're going to head over to London for the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Syria faced growing economic sanctions and condemnation over gross human rights violations today, but President Bashar al-Assad showed no sign of buckling under international pressure to end his military crackdown on popular unrest. State television broadcast pro-Assad rallies supporting national unity and rejecting foreign interference after the Arab League imposed sanctions yesterday. The European Union weighed in, further tightening the financial screws on Damascus for its brutality and unwillingness to change course. Egyptians voted in droves today in the first election since the fall of Hosni Mubarak, giving Islamists a chance to make political gains, even as the army generals who replaced him cling to power. Turnout in the country's first free poll in decades was high, and as the day wore on, Egypt's ruling military said voting would be extended 2 hours later than scheduled. Fears of unrest did not appear to have deterred voters. There were no reports of serious violence. This farmer, Ali Abdallah, is just one of many who are fed up with Egypt's old guard.
I will vote for someone younger, like in the other countries, like in America, where the president is under 50. We want someone who understands the problem of the younger people.
Germany and France stepped up a drive today for coercive powers to reject Eurozone members' budgets that breach EU rules, as a market rout of European debt eased temporarily on hopes of outside help for Italy and Spain. The OECD, rich nations' economic think tank, said the European Central Bank should cut interest rates and abandon its reluctance to step up purchases of government bonds to restore confidence in the euro area, which now pose the main risk to the world economy. Britain's Chancellor George Osborne insists Europe is on the right track.
But what is clear from the OECD is that these are very difficult economic times for many countries in the Western world, and the OECD is predicting deep recessions in many European countries. That is a challenge for Britain. Actually, I think the public is behind what the government's doing.
Non-governmental organisations taking part in crunch climate talks in Durban today have called for urgent action to prevent the death of the flagging Kyoto Protocol. The NGOs were speaking at a media event at the opening of the COP17, the Conference of the Parties Climate Conference, which has 2 weeks to strike a deal among nations with competing agendas that will save the Kyoto Protocol by making major cuts in greenhouse gas emissions that scientists blame for rising temperatures, wilder weather and crop failures. Alden Meyer of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
So I think the real question here is can the European Union and others in the Kyoto process that want to stay in Kyoto and build on it reach an understanding with the key developing countries, the small island states, the LDCs and others, that produces a successful outcome at the end of next week?
Canada dismissed the Kyoto Protocol on climate change as a thing of the past, but declined to confirm a media report it will formally pull out of the international treaty before the end of this year. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Nick. And now let's have a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And let's start the weather with stormy Europe. And much of northern Europe will be experiencing severe winds, damaging at times this weekend. Heavy rain will accompany the storms. In some areas of northern Europe, winds may be gusting up to or over 120 kilometres an hour. Here's Saturday's city forecast. In London, 13 Celsius and windy conditions. Frankfurt, 7 degrees, partly cloudy. Rome, 15 Celsius and sunny. In Copenhagen, 6 degrees, high winds and showers. Air travel, certainly a potential for disruption at airports across Europe this weekend, given the impending stormy weather. That's from the UK to Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and possibly into northern Germany. For North America, a lot of sunny autumn weather across the entire eastern half of the United States this Friday, above average temperatures. However, Saturday, it'll start raining in the Midwest. Here's Saturday's city forecast. In New York City, 14 Celsius and cloudy. Washington, D.C., 14 degrees, also cloudy. Atlanta, 18 Celsius, partly cloudy. In San Francisco, the city by the bay, 18 Celsius and cloudy conditions. Let's have a look at Australia now, and wet weather is heading for Sydney and many other cities across southeastern parts of Australia. Looks like Friday and Saturday will have the wettest weather, but by Sunday, the clouds should break and the sun is back again. So Saturday's city forecast. In Sydney, 21 Celsius and rain. Melbourne, 21 degrees, also rain. Brisbane, 27, sun and showers. And in Perth, 26, partly cloudy. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas. It is 13:07 here in Washington. You're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Es ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Ein Monocle 24 Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja auch gesagt.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Ja, Provojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live today from Washington, D.C. Now, our first guest is no stranger to Monocle 24, but this is the first time we've actually got him in the studio. Our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, is currently working on his new book, The Victory Lab, which is all about the science of political campaigns. To talk about that and everything else on the U.S. political scene, Sasha, welcome indeed.
And welcome to you guys.
Well, yes, we are in your city,
yes.
Really. So, yeah, that's right, you should be welcoming us. Let's start with looking at where we're at with the Republican race. It's been, certainly for outsiders like ourselves, it's been great fun to watch. Has it been slightly scary for you to watch as an American that these are the best guys they can come up with?
No, I mean, we've seen sort of weak political fields before. It's rare that we see a party that... In so many other ways, should be sort of having a moment. You know, Obama's weak. When pollsters ask whether the country's in the right track or the wrong track, the numbers are sort of unprecedentedly bad for the administration and sort of staggering. They have this, you know, one of our two major political parties that's controlled Congress for the last year and can't muster a candidate with any sustained enthusiasm within his or her own party, let alone you know, any seeming ability to cross over in a real way to independence and you know, Democrats who are sort of disillusioned with Obama. So it's what's sort of staggering is how many Republicans think that they're blowing, you know, what should be a very good year for them.
And was there anyone else who didn't get into the race you think actually could have made a bit of an impression?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there are probably half dozen people that went through the process of thinking about it and chose to get out, all for different reasons. But you look at somebody like Mitch Daniels, who's the governor of Indiana, who's not flashy but a sort of serious guy and has a pretty good record on budgets and deficits, and I think would sort of mix the, you know, the Romney profile of being a sort of credible leader. He has experience in the private sector. He's somebody who could have a little bit of John Huntsman's appeal to independence, and at the same time, the space that Gingrich has sort of moved into of being the sort of thinking man in the race. You know, I think Daniels would get a lot of that cred. He's probably the one who had the sort of most broad-based, could sort of check the most boxes. But somebody like Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, is exciting and dynamic in a way that none of the candidates in this race have been.
And do you think any of them are sort of slightly kicking themselves now that they didn't go for it?
I don't know. I mean, I think all of them had some version of personal reasons for deciding not to, and that's a math that doesn't entirely change for people. And we have seen enough examples of people who get in despite having personal reservations. And I think Rick Perry is one who may kick themselves afterwards for not sort of trusting their gut on that stuff. One person who I think that there are already a lot of sort of what if questions is Tim Pawlenty, who was sort of was in the race for the first 6 months of this year as the sort of steady, boring, mainstream conservative alternative to Romney, failed to sort of define a space other than trying to be the default to Romney, never really got any movement in Iowa where he needed to win. Michelle Bachmann sort of took his mojo at the right moment, and he dropped out of the race because he couldn't raise money. And he's a guy who now you sort of look at this field where everybody's trying to find somebody other than Romney to settle down with, and there's nothing like glaringly disqualifying about him, which there is about Herman Cain and Michelle Bachmann and Newt Gingrich and the long list of other people. And to keep somebody,
it's come to that though. That it's, you know, there's nothing glaringly disqualifying about him, and that is therefore a good thing.
That's right. And you know, and here's a guy who sort of put in the work for 6 months, which is something that still to this day, you know, arguably Gingrich and Cain and some of the people who are in the race have not actually done a whole lot of sort of aggressive campaigning.
I presume that a lot of the candidates are already seeing what their numbers are, and they must know that the game's up. Is there no tradition of kind of pulling out of the race at this point, even if you've been kind of marred in sexual scandals or you've been making a fool of yourself on TV with your inability to answer the most basic questions?
I mean, there has been. I mean, people have dropped out of races all the time in the past. Usually there are people with something to salvage, a reputation, a fundraising base, a desire to run in the future and don't want to look like a loser more than they have to. The problem with the people in this race is most of them don't have a whole lot. They're still at the sort of high point of their public career. I mean, Herman Cain's probably never going to get a moment like he has now, so he might as well ride it. And the other thing that's really changed in American politics is the extent to which being a former presidential candidate is just very valuable. So, Fox News basically seems to give out automatically a show or a sort of pundit contract to anybody who's run for president as a Republican. Your book deals start to look more valuable. Your speaking fees go up 5 or 10 times. There's a sort of whole like employment class in the United States of being a former presidential candidate, and it's pretty lucrative. And part of that means sticking around long enough that people remember that you ran for president.
So someone like Cain would be clinging on, knowing that you know that there is probably business sense and there's kind of financial sense for him holding on.
Yeah, and you know, I think I can look back in the last generation. I can think of only a couple of people who've come out of a presidential campaign worse in terms of what they can earn at the very least, if not the sort of value of their public profile for having run and lost. And it just puts you in a whole nother category. You know, corporate boards want you, international speak. I mean, there's just a whole marketplace for having done this. And so yeah, Herman Cain is a great example. Nobody knew who he was 8 months ago, and now there's a sort of whole world of opportunities open to him that weren't there before. And I don't think he's gotten to the point yet where the curve turns back around and starts punishing him. We could get there. It's a long month till Iowa.
Well, indeed, yes, and so many things have happened. I want to ask you briefly about Rick Perry, because you've written quite a lot about him. In your book, The Victory Lab, one of the chapters is about Rick Perry's campaign for governor in 2006. Have you been surprised at how badly his campaign has imploded?
I've been surprised at how bad he is. I mean, I still think that I got very lucky. I put out this ebook in late August with the title "Brainiest Political Operation in America," and I found the 2 week window when it didn't seem ridiculous. And every minute since then has seemed to sort of debunk the premise of my chapter. I think strategically and tactically they haven't done anything terribly wrong. He has just been horribly underprepared. I think there's sort of two parts. One is the preparation. You know, that from going from being a statewide official to being somebody talking about national and international issues, there's a lot of stuff you have to learn. You have to be able to speak about authoritatively. You have to answer questions in situations you're not used to. More people are watching you at any given minute, and that's why people who've run before, like Mitt Romney, John McCain, George H.W. Bush, tend to do better because it's almost like a practice run. And why having a long, despite all these people who thought about getting in late, why having a long runway to lift off is really valuable, because it sort of sharpens your skills. So part of it is he got in very late. He was pushed into debates within a number of weeks from getting in the race. And then you just see, wow, he quite possibly doesn't have an attention span that can last 90 minutes, which may or may not be, it's not a constitutional requirement, but it may be something you want in
most
the leader.
Most voters tend to prefer it.
Yeah, I mean, at least most citizens would probably like their leader to be able to not have their mind drift away after 45 minutes. And then, clearly, like most governors, I think, in the country, he's not ready to talk about, you know, issues that aren't part of on the state docket. And so he, you know, was in many ways very good at being governor of Texas, which has a very aggressive media culture, a lot of pressure. But, you know, there are half dozen things you talk about regularly when you're governor of Texas. You talk about the education system, the penal system, water rights. And now he's out talking about, you know, Libya and the constitutionality of healthcare reform. And he doesn't sound that authoritative. And that's
the three departments he wants to get rid of.
And the three departments, which he probably never had to think about before, you know, a year ago. And so we're seeing a guy sort of learn how to run for president while doing it on a stage with, you know, 10 million people watching each time, and it's actually not that pretty.
But it's quite funny to watch.
It's going to be quite funny to watch.
Let's talk about the Victory Lab, which comes out later this autumn, or fall, as you guys say here.
Yeah.
How do you feel that the science of political campaigns has changed over the past 5-10 years? Are you seeing things in this electoral cycle which weren't happening in 2008 or 2004?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this general arc, and sort of bulk of the story takes place since 2000, which I think quietly began the sort of transformation of our political system. And a few things happened there. You start to get all this individual level data on voters. And so campaigns who used to sort of see voters as a function of the precinct in which they lived began because they were able to get information from commercial marketers and integrate it with sort of new computing power, be able to sort of see you as an individual and talk to you differently than your neighbor, which was entirely new. And so part of what's happened is we've had this huge sort of cultural change in American campaigns, where I think we've seen this run of campaigns that have been more person-to-person oriented, more volunteer-centric. Howard Dean was like this, George W. Bush's re-election in 2004, certainly Obama in 2008. And they tend to get written about in the political media as these great sort of humanistic moment, a candidate that inspires people. And really, it's the campaigns finally have the tools to measure what individual relationships between people are worth when it comes to earning votes. And that's been the big change.
And this is both parties that are doing this at the same sort of rate, or are you seeing that some campaigns are a lot smarter than others?
Some campaigns are smarter than others. Some institutions, like there's some labor unions, which are surprisingly smart about this. And individual tools sort of leapfrog one another. But it's, you know, it's like any sort of innovation battle. One person gets ahead, it scares the other person into developing something new to catch up.
Sasha, thanks very much for coming to see us. I know you're going to stick around for the rest of the show, which is Midori House live from Washington, D.C. And you're listening to Monocle 24. But now it's time for a song. And this is, very aptly, Washington, D.C. by Magnetic Fields.
W-A-S-H-I-N-G.
That was the rather aptly named Washington, D.C. by Magnetic Fields. You're listening to Midori House here in Washington, D.C. with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck. Now, elections in Egypt, economic sanctions in Syria, and a power vacuum in Yemen. For those journalists in the West covering the Middle East, things have never been busier. But the stories are just as fascinating and as important for Arab journalists covering the West. Hisham Mellem is the Washington bureau chief for Al Arabiya, one of the region's leading television news channels, and he joins us in the studio now. Hisham, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for coming indeed. Let's start by talking about Egypt and what's happening there. Obviously, there's elections today. There was a lot of toing and froing in the few days beforehand about whether they were really going to happen. How important do you think these elections are in Egypt's revolution?
They are important, but they are not as important as those people who led the revolution back in January hoped for. These elections were designed by the SCAF, the Supreme Council for the Military, who are really running the country now, to get the kind of results that they want. And that's why you've seen hesitation on the part of the liberals, the progressives, the non-Islamists, who felt that the electoral system was so confusing, so convoluted, that it could lead to results that would benefit the most disciplined and organized political groups in the country, mainly the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's why they wanted to have more time for campaigning. And unfortunately, they did not do their share of real politicking while they were demonstrating in the streets and complaining, as they should, because they feel that the first aims and objectives of their uprising or revolt, if you want to call it that way, were being undermined. The Islamists were doing the retail politics. They were organizing and they were campaigning, and they were benefiting from their discipline and their experience operating underground for decades. We are expecting that when the elections are done, and these are elections in stages, they are staggered over a long period of time, that the Islamists will have the lion's share of seats. But it's a very convoluted electoral system. And the main concern for a lot of people, especially those who led the uprising, is that in the end, SCAF, the ruling military council, will try to do what the Turkish army did back in 1960, which is to have a special place in Egyptian politics. And that's the thing that concerns most of those people who led the revolution.
Hisham, as you interpret this story, are you concerned that actually the coverage has been very simplistic, and in fact people are just expecting a kind of each of these countries to kind of pop over some kind of Western style democracy, but in fact, you know, as you're explaining, it's very much more complicated than that, and you don't really know what the end story is yet?
When I look at Egypt, Tunisia and Libya and now Yemen, sometimes I wonder that what we have seen so far may be the decapitation of the regime in each country. That is, the head of the regime is gone. If you take Egypt, for instance, and since we're talking about Egypt, let's talk about the analogy of the pyramid. If you want to use that analogy, you'd see that the head of the pyramid, the tip of the pyramid, Mubarak and his sons and his cronies are out. But the pyramid itself is still there. By that, I mean the security structure, the economic structure, the political culture, and even the cultural structure that allowed Mubarak to rule Egypt for 30 years and the four generals to rule Egypt since 1952. And now we have a bunch of generals running Egypt today. That structure that allowed these generals to rule Egypt is still basically intact. How you chip away at this structure, how you undermine the structure, will be the essence of revolution. If this does not happen, then you really do not have a revolution. You have a decapitation of a regime. And this is really the trick. And that's why I never call them revolutions. That's why I never call them Arab Spring. At best, these are uprisings. We know that they are historic, and actually when I look back at the monumental weeks in December, in 3 weeks, 4 weeks that led to the departure of the first Arab autocrat, Zain al-Abidin Ben Ali, and then the monumental weeks in January and February that led Mubarak to flee Cairo, I'm reminded of what Lenin said once, that sometimes decades pass and nothing happens, and sometimes in weeks, decades happen. So these are important events, obviously, but this is a process that's still unfolding, and it's way too early to make any kind of a long-lasting prediction as to where we are going. My fear, and you know, I don't want to sound like a Cassandra, you know, preaching gloom and doom, but when I look around at Egypt in particular, or Yemen, or Libya, I see monumental challenges, before we can talk about a really Arab Spring or a real empowerment for the people there.
And do you think that enough people understand those complications and the complexity of it? Or do you think, as Andrew said, there's been quite a simplistic telling of these tales, that they're revolutions, and that now democracies come to Tunisia, democracies come to Egypt, and things are going to improve?
I mean, there is a debate. There is a debate among intellectuals and activists about these things. When you look at all of these countries, the four countries that we mentioned, where we've seen change at the top, maybe Tunisia is the only country that could make it, precisely because of its history, because it has more than Egypt and Yemen and Libya, secular traditions. There is an anecdote that you'll probably appreciate. In 1846, Tunisia abolished slavery 17 years before the United States. In the mid-1850s, they had a great reformer, Khair ed-Din al-Tunisi. So there is a tradition of reform in Tunisia, and to a lesser extent in Egypt. The first president of Tunisia after independence, Habib Bourguiba, enacted universal suffrage in 1957. He abolished polygamy He wanted people to work during Ramadan. I mean, these may not be revolutionary for you and me, but they were revolutionary for the Tunisians. So you have in Tunisia, somewhat like Turkey, a tradition of secularism that could allow people. You have a higher education level of education. Women's rights are more advanced. Even the economy is better than neighboring countries. So Tunisia may be well positioned to make that process towards more empowerment and a truly Arab Spring.
Hisham, so from here in Washington, I'm wondering sort of what you make of the way the administration has interacted in sort of each of the different situations across the region. Do you see any sort of consistent thread to how Obama has sort of interacted with you know, among Libya, Egypt, Syria, Yemen? And do you think that to folks within the region that there's a sort of clearer set of policies and priorities from Washington?
You know, sometimes I'm sympathetic to the administration in the sense that you get the sense at times that you have a system overload. I mean, they have to deal with all of these crises, and you have a number of people who are involved in these, you know, following these things, these monumental events in a number of countries. Not only the four countries that we mentioned, but of course you have Syria, which is a huge mess, and you have Bahrain and others. And in some cases, the United States had a great deal of strategic, economic, and political investment, such as in Egypt. I think the way the Obama administration dealt with Egypt, allowing for some, you know, bumpy beginnings and, you know, wobbly moves early on the whole, the president put the United States on the side of the people, essentially. And I think his decision on Libya, even to be involved militarily, albeit in a limited way, did, you know, work out well. I think also they pushed for the process of change in Yemen. In Bahrain, they were wobbly initially because of the Americans, a fleet headquartered in Bahrain since 1949. But in his May speech, Obama did criticize the Bahraini government. So you can talk about some hesitations here and there, some decisions that were not great. But on the whole, I think the Obama administration realized that there is a change, a kind of historic change in this region, and the United States has to be on the side of the people. But the question, you know, always boils down to how you balance the imperatives and the requirements of bilateral relationship and your values and the belief in democracy, given the historic American view that in the past, American values and American democracy stopped at the water's edge, and that's why we found ourselves, as George Bush said in his famous second inaugural speech, in bed with the worst kinds of leaders, you know, military leaders and dictatorships in the Arab and the Muslim world during the Cold War.
Well, Hisham Malam, thank you very much for joining us today. Before you go, we asked you to choose a song for us. So would you like to announce the song that you've chosen?
I'm a blues fanatic, as I told your producer. Anything you play by Muddy Waters or Howling Wolf or Elmer James, I mean, you know, Got My Mojo Working would be great. Okay. If you have it.
Excellent.
But
certainly
anything you have.
Well, I think we have something. Hisham Mellon, thank you very much. As requested by Hisham, this is Hey Hey by Muddy Waters.
Well, that was Hey Hey by the one and only Muddy Waters. In the next half hour, Mondori House on Monocle 24, we'll be talking to Derek Brown. But first, it's back to London for the latest headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Andrew. A United Nations Commission of Inquiry has said Syrian military and security forces have committed crimes against humanity, including murder, torture and rape, for which President Assad and his government bore direct responsibility. Egyptians voted in droves today in the first election since the fall of long-time ruler Hosni Mubarak, giving Islamists a chance to make political gains, even as the army generals who replaced him cling to power. Germany and France stepped up a drive today for coercive powers to reject Eurozone members' budgets that breach EU rules, as a market rout of European debt eased temporarily on hopes of outside help for Italy and Spain. Kuwait's Prime Minister and his government resigned today in response to escalating demands by protesters and opposition deputies that he step down over corruption allegations. Turkey has offered to bow to EU demands and open its ports, airports and airspace to Cyprus to help drive Cypriot reunification talks under UN pressure for a breakthrough. Non-governmental organisations taking part in crunch climate talks in Durban today have called for urgent action to prevent the death of the flagging Kyoto Protocol. Violence erupted at four polling stations in the south of the Democratic Republic of Congo today, as the vast country held its second election since a war that killed more than 5 million people. Growing street anger over a cross-border attack by NATO forces in Afghanistan that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers over the weekend has fueled a wave of anti-American sentiment in Pakistan that gave rise to protests across the country today. And Paul Cézanne's study work of the bathers and Auguste Rodin's sculpture of the Age of Iron were exhibited in Paris today before being put up for sale at Christie's on December the 1st. The collection of 120 works is estimated at around 14 to 20 million euros. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick Kelly. You're listening to Midori House in Washington, D.C. with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck.
Now, joining us in the studio is Derek Brown. With so many well-heeled residents, Washington, D.C.'s cocktail bar scene is a vibrant one. Helming it is Derek. He's the owner of the Gibson and Columbia Room cocktail bars, as well as the Better Drinking Company, which holds bartending and drinks events across America. Derek, I first wanted to ask you, can you just tell us quickly what makes your cocktail bars special, why you have become kind of a dominant force in this city?
Absolutely. Let me first start by one correction. I don't actually own the Gibson, the Columbia Room, and Passenger.
We've extended your empire.
That's okay by me. It is a great bar in Washington, D.C., and I previously was a consultant for there and a bartender there.
You can take the credit. It's fine.
But the Columbia Room is where I bartend there. And also, it's I think one of the unique bars leading Washington, D.C.'s cocktail renaissance. And the reason for that is that we really, you know, we have a very small, intimate environment. It's a 10-seat cocktail bar. And we get to do something that most bars don't get to do, and that's take time with our guests. And so we really got influenced from a sort of global scene. I mean, I take a chance to travel as much as I can throughout the world to see great cocktail bars. And I'm happy to see that they're really popping up everywhere. Recently, I was in Paris and they have a vibrant cocktail scene once again, because obviously toward the late 19th century and early 20th century, you really had the eruption of cocktail bars there and sort of this renaissance there too, or LA or Tokyo, which is where I got the inspiration for the Columbia Room.
And actually, tell me, are you going back to these old school cocktails? Because actually what's interesting is when you go around the world, many of the best cocktail bars now, they're taking their inspirations from the old American speakeasies. They're going back to kind of recipes from the 30s and 40s. There seems to be a desire to go back to kind of more troubled times, as it were. You know, maybe that's a reflection of the time we're living in now. Right.
Well, it's interesting because I don't know if it's so much a reflection of troubled times as it is a reflection of this great, vibrant cocktail scene. I mean, we sometimes refer to the late 19th century and early 20th century in cocktails as the golden era of cocktails. That's when you had professional bartenders who had invented some of the greatest cocktails that we think about today, whether the martini, Manhattan, daiquiri, and so on. And today you could really refer to it as the platinum era. I mean, you have so much more. You have all those great recipes, plus new techniques, new sort of ways of doing things.
I'm intrigued by what you say about you like to travel around the world to see other cocktail bars. Where are the places you've been in the past 12 months that have really inspired you, which were perhaps a little bit surprising?
Right. I'd say that my four favorite places I've traveled to this year were in Paris. To see just how, I mean, I went to this place called Candelaria. It's amazing. It's in the back of a taco stand. And they have this really gorgeous bar. And there they have no wine, right? I mean, right. That seems unbelievable for Paris. But they're making some of the best cocktails that I've had all year. I'd say LA also has a really great cocktail scene right now. Especially one of my favorite places in the world is Tasting Kitchen and Abbot Kinney. And they're doing great work of their very fresh kind of seasonal cocktails. And that's that evolution from, you know, cocktail bars of the past, not just classic cocktails, but they're taking it another step. I'd also add Chicago has a really vibrant scene, a place called Aviary, especially where they're really innovating cocktails. Grant Achatz, who is arguably one of the best chefs in the world, has set up a place where they're also applying this sort of, you know, modern cuisine to cocktails as well.
So I was going to ask you a question, actually, connected to this. How much business is done over a martini in the city? Is this a place where, actually, it's important to have a cocktail bar to go at the end of the day away from Capitol Hill, where you kind of, you take the senator, you do a bit of business on the quiet over a drink?
Yeah, I mean, I think the martini lunches are gone, and you see very little drinking during the day.
Oh, no.
But, no,
well, that's what we're doing after this.
You see very little drinking in bars, but not necessarily no drinking.
No, that's right. And I think it's a city where hotel bars have always done incredibly well, and I think that hotel bars have had a sort of culture of cocktails even when they've been lost in other types of bars, right?
Absolutely. And the fact is that that is how we entertain ourselves in Washington, D.C. We entertain ourselves by going out for a drink. Yeah. So, you know, if you're in Boulder, Colorado, you all are going to go out and go hiking or something. In D.C., you and your friends go out.
And what's the challenge for you as a man who makes cocktails? You know, because I would imagine that although there's all these great classic recipes, the temptation, and that's obviously the bad temptation for some cocktail waiters, is endlessly to be inventing and making new things and new flavors. Are you torn between just doing classics well and doing something that becomes your kind of signature?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. The thing is that all of the greatest cocktails have already been invented. So we're just adding on to that and actually changing aspects of it. You can look at, like I mentioned, Aviary, and also locally, there's a program that I consult on. It's called Rogue 24. It's a restaurant that has a 24-course tasting menu. And there we try to do something slightly different with cocktails. We use things like rotary evaporators, dehydrators, blast chillers, all of these different tools, and what we're really doing is taking the most classic recipes, we're changing the texture or we're changing the presentation of it. So I'll give you an example. We have one drink that's called the Three Martini Lunch, also going back to the classic DC lunch, and we present three glasses that look identical, all like a classic martini. One of them's a Manhattan, one of them's a daiquiri, and one of them is a classic martini. And we use different techniques to get, for instance, the daiquiri, we clarify the lime juice so it's completely clear. But all three of them look the same. So these are classic cocktails, but the presentation is slightly different. It's something unique and something, you know, that I hope people can have fun with.
Derek, one of the things I think that those of us who live and work in Washington don't always fully appreciate, and other people in the United States don't at all, is the extent to which Washington's an international city, and I think so much of the economic and social engine of the city is foreigners, often transient, who are here diplomacy, the institutions. I'm wondering, from your perspective, especially in hospitality and food, do you see the influence of sort of the global money and tastes, and where is it sort of manifest, whether on your menu or in other restaurants around the city?
I definitely think that Washington, D.C. has one of the most sophisticated group of drinkers. I'm really happy to say not only do we drink more per capita than any city in the United States, that we also have such a great group of drinkers. So when people come into my bar, they're not surprised that there's an egg white and a pisco sour. You know, that they are familiar with Japanese whiskey. So I really get a broad, you know, group of drinkers who are smart, honestly. And I enjoy that because I think that the best kind of drinking is smart drinking.
What's interesting when you're describing how you make the cocktails now, it almost sounds a bit like the molecular thing that's happening in cookery. Right. Are you borrowing from the world of food as well as you make your drinks?
That's exactly what has happened over the last couple of years, that bartenders are starting to integrate those techniques into shaking, stirring, and muddling. So now it's not uncommon at all for a bartender to know how to spherify liquid so that they can add these caviar bubbles of Cointreau or what have you in their drinks. So I'm borrowing from that. As I mentioned, Aviary in Chicago is sort of leading the charge from that. And it's really, it's kind of a cool moment in cocktails, right? This is the platinum age. This is a chance for people to not only drink the classics, but drink the evolved classics. And I think that that's a great time and a great place in Washington, D.C. and around the world.
Yeah. Well, I think we can all raise a glass to that. Derek Brown, thank you very much.
You're
listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now time for a song. And what are we going to play next, Steve?
We're going to play You Know What You Want, But You Won't Get It by George Levin.
Well, that was George Levin with You Know What You Want, But You Won't Get It. And if you want to know the connection with Washington, there isn't one. Well, I suppose George, it was the first name of a certain person who had Washington as a second name. But anyway, we were with
him. I think that's a good enough link.
That's a good enough link.
I think that is.
I think it's a good enough link for us this afternoon. Anyway,
it is.
You're back with the Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and Steve Bloomfield.
Now, earlier today, Harvard's Professor of International Relations, Stephen Walt, spoke to Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, about the myth of American exceptionalism. And she started by asking if policymakers in the US use soft power as a tool in international relations.
I think certainly there's an awareness among U.S. policymakers that what some have called soft power can be an important asset. And there have been attempts to try and, you know, alter American foreign policy conduct or at least American foreign policy rhetoric to take advantage of it. The concept is, I think, you know, now become pretty widely used part of the foreign policy vocabulary. Whether it's the kind of thing that governments can really manipulate to their own advantage, I think, remains to be seen. Although the basic answer to your question is yes, people are trying to exploit it to advance the American position.
And do you think that the soft power is in tandem with the foreign policy of the nation, or do you think it's more of a kind of autonomous sort of cultural sort of viral concept?
Well, first of all, soft power really does flow from so-called hard power. There aren't a lot of countries that are, you know, sort of weak and impoverished that have a lot of soft power. So it flows in part from being a major power to begin with. Secondly, it's the attractive qualities of one's society, you know, to include culture, to include the nature of the political system, the lives that individuals are able to lead. And there can be real contradictions between the way a country behaves in its foreign policy conduct and its attempt to build on its soft, so-called soft power. So it seems to me when the United States, you know, does things like accidentally killing 25 Pakistani soldiers, that's contrary to the idea of building soft power. It probably undermines the American image in Pakistan and makes our situation there more difficult.
And do you think that the Republicans are sort of using their lack of knowledge of international relations as a sort of badge of honor?
That's a great question. I don't think so. I don't think that will ultimately play well. There are a few Americans who probably, you know, are suspicious of those who have a sophisticated knowledge of how the world really works. But I think in general, most Americans would like the president to be someone who is knowledgeable about foreign affairs, who has sensible ideas, has a clear strategy for how he wants to engage the rest of the world. And the sense that that your future president really knows nothing is not a good idea. I might add, you know, even former President Bush had to try and demonstrate foreign policy credentials back in 2000, even though his were pretty weak. Having said all that, I would just add, I think the more important issue will be the state of the American economy, and that's going to dominate any foreign policy issue in the 2012 election.
And what do you think the consequences for soft power would be if the Republicans did actually take office?
Well, it depends, I think, almost entirely on the policies that they subsequently adopted. That how a country's soft power evolves over time is going to be based in part, as I said before, on sort of how its hard power is sustained. But if the United States were to revert to the kind of policies we followed under President Bush, then I think you'd expect to see America's image deteriorate, as it did under former President Bush, and its soft power to decline. On the other hand, if a Republican president came in and acted in a more sensible and moderate fashion, then you might actually see the overall soft power go up somewhat as people began to realize this wasn't a partisan quality, this was an innate feature of the United States itself.
And what's the debate in the US about whether or not America should be this sort of global police force? Do you think that that's a kind of evolving and changing subject? And maybe you could just tell me a bit about how you see the idea of American influence around the globe sort of changing.
I think there's considerable ambivalence in the United States, and we're going to see a lot of contestation around this. On the one hand, Americans like the idea of the United States being a global leader, if not the global leader, and there's been a great deal of bipartisan support for that role for many years, really for decades. On the other hand, at the same time, most Americans recognize that the United States is not in great shape at the moment, that the American economy has some real problems. There's going to have to be budget cuts, including the Pentagon, which is going to limit what the United States can do around the world. And there is also a sense that we've gotten overcommitted in a few places that didn't work out particularly well, like Iraq and Afghanistan. So Americans would like the country to remain a major power, remain an influential world leader, but there has been a certain fatigue, I guess, that has set in with trying to do almost everything in every part of the world, and I think there's a recognition that that's going to have to change. We're going to have to be a little bit more selective.
And we saw quite a lot of Americans sort of flagellating during the Bush era, and that's changed a lot. Americans are more confident about having real pride in their nation. Do you think that's something that could change?
Oh, that could easily change. I mean, I think the most critical thing is if we got a second recession, if the economy sort of spirals back down, then I think you will see a considerable backlash against both parties, in fact, for having mismanaged things. And we're starting to see a little bit of that with the sort of Occupy Wall Street movements and things like that. I do think the United States is an unusually patriotic country. There's a lot of positive feeling in general. And the fact that there was a certain amount of what you were calling flagellating during the Bush administration isn't surprising, given what had happened by the end of his second term. I think a new president, whether it's a new Republican president or President Obama getting reelected, could retain a lot of popular support, but primarily if the policies they adopt seem to work out well. You know, Americans are ultimately pragmatists, like most people around the world. They tend to reward successful policies, and they tend to get upset when things don't work.
And do you think that we'll see politicians taking soft power much more seriously? And do you think there'll be an effort to really try and fix some pockets of anti-Americanism that sort of sprung up around the world?
Well, I don't think you can fix those pockets of anti-Americanism through soft power. I mean, the idea that you can cajole people or fool people into thinking that they should like the United States when they don't, just by presenting, you know, a more favorable face to them, isn't going to work. Ultimately, where the real pockets of anti-Americanism exist, it's usually because there's anger at specific American policies. And some of those policies, in my view, are misguided. So you're not going to improve the American image in much of the Arab and Islamic world if American policies towards many of those places don't change as well. In other words, what I'm suggesting is there is a limit to how far you can go with soft power. If the actions your government is taking are disliked by other people, putting a nice face on it and talking about what great movies Hollywood makes and what wonderful universities the United States has isn't going to get you very far.
Well, that was Professor of International Relations Stephen Walt. You're listening to Midori House live from Washington.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Then a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24, your cousin.
This is Monocle 24.
Tama on Monocle Coxigumatanaria.
The Bropajalavet. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
And this is Monocle 24, live from Washington, D.C. And that's almost it for Midori House, for our first ever outside broadcast.
And it's gone quite well, I think. I think we could probably go and toast ourselves with a few cocktails, actually, after this.
I want to try the three martini lunch.
As a Washingtonian, I was very pleased that one of our guests patted me on the back for being a good and smart drinker. Which...
But it is interesting that it's such a city with a higher rate of drinking than say, L.A. or than New York, that you know, it must be something embedded in the way that you do business in this city.
I think it's doing business. It's definitely a sort of convention meeting, business traveler town, obviously, and I think that a certain amount of alcohol tends to...
But is there a fun side to being in D.C. as a resident? You know, you always think that people are probably kind of fleeing to kind of New York and things for their fun, but actually, is this a fun city to live in?
I think there's a lot of institutional fun, which is...
Institutional fun? What's that?
It's a bit of an oxymoron, surely.
A lot of scheduled fun, people... A lot of parties, events, alcohol flowing at all of them. I don't think it's a city with a lot of sort of improvised or... particularly creative fun, but if your idea of fun is finding some taxpayer indirectly to pay for your drinks in a hotel ballroom or a defense contractor to do so, there's plenty of fun to be had.
Well, we don't have a taxpayer paying for us, but we do have a kind of bit of institutionalized fun ourselves.
Yeah, so. It will be good fun. It won't be Yeah, it won't be depressing.
And as you said, there's an amazing kind of guest list, so it'll be interesting to see some of the conversations we have, because we've seen that the Egyptian military attaché is on there. There's a good few kind of embassy kind of heads, so it's going to be an interesting evening of finding out what the world looks like from DC.
It will be. Before we go, I must just say my favourite bit of the entire show was sadly something which was visual rather than audio, which was Hisham Mellem's reaction when we played Hey Hey by Muddy Waters.
Which I assume he has on his own iPod.
I'm sure he does. He's sort of, you know, fist pumping in the air in celebration. Yeah,
he looked so happy.
He did. We're going to play one more song before we go, but that is it for this Monday edition of Midori House live here from Washington, D.C. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump in London and Aisha Spears here in Washington. Our studio manager was Alex Funnell. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow from New York at 2200 hours London time. Our colleagues will be back with the Monocle Daily live from London. Until then, we'll be playing you out with possibly the most famous singer to ever be born in Washington, I think. Are we willing to say that?
He was born here. We're not quite sure after speaking to Sasha that he was raised here, but anyway.
But certainly born in Washington. This is Marvin Gaye, Got to Give It Up. For now, from all of us here at Monocle 24, goodbye.